You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Ann Carson. I'm very happy to have her on the show today because it's my opinion that she is simply the most interesting poet writing today. Last year saw two books virtually published simultaneously. One was Plain Water, Essays in Poetry. The other is called Glass, Irony, and God, published by New Directions, Plain Water from Knopf. And they are unusual in their forms. There seems to be very little distinction made between prose and poetry, and a very great freedom in the poetic line, a great amorphousness between autobiographical subject and external subject. And I wanted to ask first about form, because it seems that finding the form for a piece is very important to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's the beginning, the most important part of the beginning. I used to think when I was younger and writing that each idea had a certain shape. And when I started to study Greek and I found the word morphe, it was to me just the right word for that. Unlike shape in English, which falls a bit short, morphe in Greek means the sort of plastic contours that an idea has inside your all your senses when you grasp it the first moment. And it always seemed to me that a work should play out that same contour in its form. So I can't start writing something down till I get a sense of that morphe. And then it unfolds, I wouldn't say naturally, but it unfolds gropingly by keeping only to the contours of that form, whatever it is.
It would seem that the series of poems that you've been doing that have been going under the title TV Man, mm-hmm. which includes very personal forms of documentary biographies of Tolstoy, of Hector, of Artaud, mm-hmm. That this is, in a way, making fun of imposed form, the form of the television show, the having a week to prepare an hour on Tolstoy, you mm-hmm. know? And it's almost as if the formal element there is the parading of the inconsistency between what one would like to do at one's most deepest mm-hmm. level of response compared to the surface provided week after week by a television format.
I guess television is that form where the tension between those two is most sharp. I think in writing the TV Men, the different parts of it, I've been trying to include that tension in a more respectful description of what TV actually aims to do. And I don't I say that hesitatingly because I think TV is awful and should never have been invented and is bringing civilization swiftly to its demise. Nonetheless, there are people working in TV and there are ideas that come and go in the form of TV that are worth contemplating. And some of those, I've tried to come around to some of those through this what you describe it, and it seems to me when I'm doing it a fairly superficial satire of the necessary discrepancy between the form and the content in the actual medium. And I don't think yet that I've quite figured out how to do that. But I wanted to suggest both that the form is hopeless, I mean the medium of TV is hopeless, and that nonetheless, within it from time to time, surface highly significant things.
Now, terror, it seems to me, plays a part in your poetry. That is to say that in the most recently published section of TV Man, which is about Lazarus, and it's in the movie's issue of the Parnassus Review. I do want to praise the Parnassus Review. It's one of my favorite current literary magazines. But you see, you have Lazarus coming back to life, but it's also coupled with the idea that Lazarus comes back to life in a retake. So it, almost as if in that world there is no choice but that Lazarus would come back to life again and again and again.
Which would be truly horrible.
And terrifying, yes. Poor Tithonus.
But that's the thing about TV, as I learned when I did it, the experience out of which TV Men arose was an involvement in a TV program, and that was the most horrifying aspect of the experience, simply having to repeat a piece of language 26, 27, 28 times and watching real words, words which I had in fact written, go dead inevitably. You can't keep words from going dead when you repeat them 27 times.
What was that experience?
It was a PBS documentary series, three programs called The Nobel Legacy. You may or may not have seen it. It was shown in 1995. It was about the Nobel Science Prizes, their history, and it attempted to critique the values of science in light of the contrast between those and the values of humanism, whatever they are, and I was supposed to represent humanism.
Or as they put it,
yeah, I wore a pink dress. They referred to my function as putting the poetry in. It was truly awful.
Now, you have managed to help define something for me. I guess when I become as grateful to any poet, it's because they've managed to define a part of myself that has been previously unidentified.
Mm-hmm.
And not only to define it, but to make it vivid and alive. And so within Plain Water, there is a long piece, it's The Anthropology of Water, in which you talk about the consequences, you say, of being raised genderless in a home and then being, in a sense, subjected suddenly to an experience of passion and love that is totally unprepared for.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably too much for me to say that I've shared that experience, or maybe that experience is one of the great secrets. We don't acknowledge that we share it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me that the great subject here is the terror of being forced to participate in life.
Not just sexual life.
Well, I suppose for me it was any life at all, but perhaps sexual life.
I'm not sure. I think there were areas of life that I was trained by my childhood to participate in. Not, for the most part, areas I wanted to participate in, as it turned out, but I thought that was just unlucky. Didn't you? I mean, didn't you have the sense that you had the wrong parents sometimes, and that was just a misfortune that you couldn't correct?
Well, I was told that I was good when I was reading or when I was sleeping.
Oh, I had the opposite.
What was that?
Not reading.
Oh, you were good when you were not reading?
Yeah, going out to play with the others.
That you should.
Yes, I remember being forced out the screen door. I would have been happy to stay in and read.
Oh. Well, eventually there was something about fresh air that I didn't do.
Yeah, I didn't either.
But that quality, I don't know, of feeling almost paralyzed.
Yes, I was often paralyzed. But I was paralyzed both in and for myself, but also contemplating others. Were you? I remember watching these children that I was supposed to go out and play with, playing, and I had the sudden sense that they were creatures suspended on a void, that they were playing in a house that was being built, and it was half built, and so there were boards and no floor, and they were running around on the boards, and I thought, well, this is what children in life are always doing. They're on a space that they think is ground, and actually it's just these boards with big holes in, and it's my function by concentrating to keep them up on the boards and not let them go down in the space, so that there was like a link between the horror of watching children and the horror of being me, namely my responsibility to keep them up on the surface of this fake structure where we live.
It's sort of like, I think Dr. Johnson talks about in Rasselas, an astronomer who believes that if he's not watching the universe, it will stop doing what
yes.
it's supposed to. So he's always at the telescope.
Well, one feels that pressure. I guess it's a little bit egotistical. But I think it's a way of making sense of the fear that comes flooding in at the mere thought of going out, going past the screen door into that space where the others are doing their apparently effortless things, but you yourself can see that they're quite terrible things they're doing, quite death-defying things.
I'm speaking to Ann Carson, the author of two books of poems, poetry and essays, works in different forms of questioning. Plain Water is one, Glass Irony and God is the other. And do you feel that that sense of rawness or exposure that can come about is in some way countered by ambiguities, humor, nonsense?
I don't feel that's my practice. It might turn out that way, but I think I use irony not as a cover, that is something to put on after having become naked, but as a deflection in front, that is a lure thrown out ahead so that people will look over there while I'm disrobing here. By the time they look back, there'll be an image of me disrobed left, but I'll have gone into the tunnel again. So it's like, a bit of meat thrown to distract them for the moment.
Or sleight of hand.
Yes, sleight of hand.
Because, in some of them, in particular, the poem, well, two in a row, actually, they're so frightening to me. But The Truth About God is a poem divided into sections: God's Bouquet of Undying Love, God's Mother, God's Justice, the Wolf God, God's List of Liquids. But it's like being flayed. Mm. You know, that there's such a desire for a visionary experience of the punishing pleasures of having a God.
Mm-hmm.
And this is preceded by a poem about the Bronte sisters, in which the student of Emily Bronte imagines a series of nudes,
yes.
Self-incarnations
yes.
of the self being tortured and horrifyingly naked.
Yes.
And this is in turn described as Heathcliff's function as a pain devil, finds himself enamored of giving and receiving pain,
mm-hmm.
and Emily being almost the unconscious medium for the creation of pain devils.
Yes, I think she didn't mean to be unconscious. I think she was all too conscious, but other people judged her, as Charlotte did, to be in the grip, not in control of her own writing experience. Well, I don't know. I don't know what to say about nakedness.
But you see, the reader of the poem becomes an astonished witness to... When I was reading the God poem, yeah. I couldn't believe it had been accomplished. It seemed to me that before my eyes, the words had accomplished something that I had not seen before. I'd seen it attempted, but I hadn't seen it done. And I guess I'm asking what the aftermath of such a writing is.
I showed it to a friend of mine, and he said, "Doesn't work. You should read John Donne." Really. And I put it away for some years, and then got it out again and looked at them and tried to change things, and nothing would change. You know, it just wouldn't move. So I left it, sent it then to somebody, but I didn't think it was right when I did it. Didn't seem close. It was an attempt to seize God by the lapels or whatever image you have of doing that, but I had an intuition that that would have to be fairly violent and more than aggressive, but I didn't feel that I'd done it.
I remember the first time I ever thought that such a poem might be possible. I was reading Browning's Porphyria's Lover, and he sat next to this woman whom he has strangled with her hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the last line of the poem is, "And yet God has not said one single word," as if the purpose of all of this, not mm-hmm. just the activity, but the writing of the poem, was mm-hmm. to pry out of God.
A response. Yeah, well, I respect that. I guess the Sufi tradition is that we don't have to search for God. God is searching for us. But I think you have to do something pretty sensational to make God come around. He may be searching in a general way, but to make him come into your kitchen is going to require some certain action. And that's perhaps the action that one attempts over and over again in writing, and in these writings more explicitly. But it's an attempt to get some attention beyond this world.
Now, since these two books, Glass Irony and God and Plain Water, were published simultaneously, do you define them in relation to one another?
No, I don't think so. How do you mean?
Well, in certain ways, Plain Water seemed a more secular book, interested in the external world and in people venturing out into it. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Glass Irony and God books seem the work of the person who lives in the moor.
Yeah. I wish that were true. It was a lot more accidental. Literally. I sent a whole lot of things to my editor at Knopf, who was Gordon Lish, and he simply threw out most of them. And what was left turned up in Plain Water. And what was thrown out turned up in Glass Irony. More or less.
Uh-huh. So then you don't have the impulse to make the pieces within a book the way, say, people say Yeats did, into an integrity. The
I
book
do.
As a pen. Oh, you
no,
do?
No, I do. I do have that strong ambition. I couldn't get it to happen in either of these, and at the time they were published I thought, well, that's something for later life. But I've been working this year on a book that I just finished, and it has that as its purpose, to teach myself to do a book that is a book and holds together as one morphe.
Now, who are the models? I don't mean models, because that suggests modeling oneself on someone, but who are those who have successfully completed a morphe in art?
Oh, Homer, I think, chiefly. And I really do reread Homer more than anything else to get back the sense of what the project is. Sappho and the other lyric poets, too, and those are the people I mostly read. But Homer is just beyond everything.
And yet, when people, because I want to give the listener the right idea, often as not, if you say Homer is the model,
mm-hmm.
You would expect to have a poet whose work might be
a little longer.
and antique and
yes,
but these are very powerful, often frightening, removed modern poems.
Mm-hmm.
The reader, other than one who knows that you come from a background in the classics, is not likely to come away from them saying, Homer.
All too true, yes. Well, I can't help that. But so you want some more recent model?
Mm-hmm.
Sheesh, I don't know. Sophocles is a little more recent. It's not what you mean. Emily Brontë isn't a bad poet. I have this problem, though, that I read things entirely accidentally, whatever I bump into at the library or happen to have on my desk, and forget it immediately. I mean, I read and immerse and then forget. And I don't consciously look for models or have that hope.
Well, the opening of your book, Eros the Bittersweet, which again begins by posing a thrilling question, what do the ancients know of the dark side of love?
Mm-hmm.
Is love suffering for them as well? Mm-hmm. Begins with an epigraph from Kafka,
mm-hmm.
who seems to be a tutelary model throughout of sorts.
I guess so, yes. I was reading a lot of Kafka at that time, and if there's a model or a thing that I look for instead of a model, it's that kind of cleanliness that Kafka has, which Homer also has, where you can't imagine that he ever had in his mind any other than the words that he uses on the page. I'm sure he did, but it doesn't seem that way. They seem to drop right out of his mentality into language. So, but that's not exactly a formal model. It's just a spirit that inhabits certain kinds of writing or certain people's writing at certain times in their lives and not other times.
Have you any speculation of what brings it? What gives a particular artist access to what seem to be those very rare states? It doesn't seem as if it's the result of any consciously pursued art, for instance. It seems that it might drive someone to consciously pursue art, but that it proceeds
on its own.
Yes,
I think it's like, you know, the theologians describe the mystery of conversion. When does conversion begin? It means a turning of the soul. But if you turn your soul, you've already been given the idea to turn your soul by something outside you, or you wouldn't start to turn. And the answer that they give generally in the church is that it's the Holy Ghost who both suggests to your will that it might make an action and then helps that action happen, but you can call it your action. I think there's a synergetic event that is like a collaboration between this something innate in this person and his effort, his attention to that.
Now, you have spoken earlier of a process in language that's something like decay. You speak of Celan as being subjecting his words to an acid process which will take away
mm-hmm.
everything but the essential, and sometimes even beyond into the essential.
Mm-hmm.
Mementos of the essential are what is left. I notice that while the poems may have as their origin very personal states, they seem to be frozen and burned and eroded until what's left alludes to the personal but is not itself personal.
Mm-hmm. In Salon.
Yes, but in your work as well.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can see the process going on. It's very interesting. For instance, in the Anthropology of Water, first, there is a lengthy, I would say, comic allegory of the disintegration of a relationship being like a pilgrimage.
Hmm.
And then there's a move back to a previous layer where instead of a pilgrimage, we're the witness of a horrific camping trip. But somehow or other, the process is to essentialize this,
mm-hmm.
as if the camping trip and the pilgrimage are models for the experience of the incarnated soul in the world.
Oh, yay. Yeah. Sure they are. It's crystallized, yeah, but it's, well, one doesn't want to have just a lot of globs of personal life all over the writing. It's embarrassing, and there's no reason to think that's interesting to someone else. You have to carve away enough of it so that it makes sense to others, which means carving away, you know, your address, the actual stuff you ate that day, and leaving the events of a life. Otherwise, it wouldn't be any sort of a gift.
Yes, and when they are what survives after the cutaways, what is it representative of? What does it become?
It becomes a kind of a fiber, one side of which is myself, I guess, and the other side of which is some larger self, but it's two sides of one page, and they're connected because I claim to be a writer, but they are different.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Ann Carson, the author of Glass, Irony, and God, published by New Directions, Plain Water, Essays and Poetry, published by Knopf, the author as well of the essay Eros the Bittersweet, working on an essay on Simonides called Economy, and the completer of a book, The Autobiography of Red, to appear in the future. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.